first time I ran across this word was in 1932. I happened to be studying sociology, but I was in Chicago going to school, and there was a book that came out that the professor recommended highly, and it was on the topic of the ecology of a city. And it did a nice job of explaining the dynamic interrelationship of the various parts of a city. Like, for instance, the downtown area, the city park, the suburbs, their relationship to the city, how dependent the city is upon the suburbs, because that's where so many of the people who work in the inner city and in the downtown areas and the office buildings come from there, and how the city, the inner part of the city, supports the suburbs because that's where they, so many of them work and get their incomes. And then there was the area of the homeless man, that inner core just around the central part of most large cities, where the homeless people hang out. Somebody mentioned the other day that that there were more than 2,000 homeless street people in Seattle. This has also struck me that I've seen more homeless people in Seattle than in other cities of the size around. I think it's probably partly because it's a port city, partly because it's related to the lumbering industry, and a lot of the loggers during their seasonal employment, or now in the last 5 years or so, and their almost constant unemployment, have drifted into the city. Cities provide something of a haven for people who can't be comfortable in their other places and other smaller places, and they always come with some kind of hope that in the big city they'll find something that will be of help to them. Calcutta was mentioned also, where more than 50% of the people have no place to put their head except on the street, on the sidewalk, that is. I have a picture that I took out of a hotel window in Calcutta one morning, very early, and it happened to be during Holy Week and specifically on Holy Thursday. And when I woke up in the morning, I threw open the old blinds on this old, delightful old colonial hotel and looked down the street below, and the street was just wall-to-wall people down there. And I got my camera and snapped a picture of all this, kind of dramatic, you know, seeing all this. And it didn't really hit me as to what I was seeing. It was very colorful, because even the poorest people have some good sense of color in that part of the world, and so there was a lot of brilliant color down there. And then I took my shower and dressed, and I took another look out the window, and when I looked out the window the second time, all the people were gone but one. And he was lying on a stone step, two or three steps going up into some building. All these people got out because the police drive them out as soon as the city gets around its business today, and they have to go. I remember more than 50% of the people in that town have no house whatsoever, ever. And this doesn't mean that they're hardcore poverty people. It's just that the level of poverty is such that most people just don't have a house. And these aren't exceptional people, like we might find the homeless people in Seattle are somewhat exceptional. But when I saw this fellow down there, he had a little bowl beside him. I figured out later that was his beggar's bowl. And he was lying there draped over this thing in a strange kind of a posture. I snapped the picture, and it wasn't until I got into my dark room at home a month later and processed, printed that picture into a larger picture, that immediately it struck me that this was Jesus Christ. Looked so much like him on the cross, even. The physical resemblance was so much. Just the way he happened to be draped over those stones. So I started to use this slide from which I printed this picture with groups, and as soon as I'd throw it on the screen, I would just let them sit there and say nothing. And after maybe 5 minutes of letting them be exposed to this, one person through which the agony of the whole world can be seen, then I'd say, who do you suppose this myth was? And invariably people would come up and say, Jesus Christ. That homeless man area in the city is an extremely important part of the city, even though it's seen mostly in negative ways. But if we could see in the eyes of the people in the homeless areas, if we could see Jesus Christ, then perhaps the whole gospel would take on somewhat different meaning and be more intimate for us. Well, this study on the ecology of the city was very interesting to me, and it stressed the dynamic interrelationship of the parts of the city and the factions and the factors in the city. The next time the word ecology surfaced in my attention was in the 50s and 60s with the Earth Movement, you remember, as that's where we started to pay attention to this Earth. And there was a whole lot of concern, and it continues, about the pollution of our environment, the destruction of so much of this planet. The concern was based pretty largely in fear, and maybe still remains largely based in fear. We can't allow all this mercury or the PCBs to go into the rivers because it's threatening to our lives. We have to do something about acid rain because it is threatening to the lives of people all over the whole planet. We have to do something about, you know, the mercury in Lake Michigan, mostly because it's going to ruin the salmon fishing that was such a phenomenal thing in a freshwater lake. Better salmon fishing in Lake Michigan than there is out in Puget Sound. And that was a strange one because they were introduced from Puget Sound. But then everybody became concerned about the mercury level in Lake Michigan. Now there was a lot of hysteria in that also. For instance, they made some kind of miscalculation and thought that this mercury was accumulating in bigger and bigger and bigger amounts, and so somebody dragged out some old records from the pulp mill days along Lake Michigan and found that there was a whole lot more mercury in Lake Michigan back 50, 100 years ago than there has been more recently. But mercury is some kind of a concern. But this concern for what we call today, tend to call ecology, is based rather largely, I think, in some kind of a fear. Now you do find in some individuals, I suppose in most individuals, some other kinds of concern for the environment based in something other than fear, but pretty largely the motivating factor, the dynamic that's in it, is fear. What is this going to do if we allow this thing to get more polluted? Now I'm suggesting that is a it's too bad, and we're not going to make much progress if we base our concern for this planet on our fears, because you can clean up the mercury in the rivers, huh? Or the chemicals that we're dumping into them. We can clean those up, and then we say, okay, nothing to worry about. Let's trample on it some more in less dangerous ways. And I'm suggesting that if we're ever going to make any progress along these lines, it is going to be when we develop a deep and profound reverence for the very stuff of the planet itself. The task of the Christian church in this generation must be importantly related to the problem of what we're now calling ecology. Because we need to inform our brothers and sisters here and around the world about the nature of creation itself, the nature of the planet, its essential nature, and not simply look at how much garbage we happen to dump around or how many tin cans go along the roadsides or bottles or whatever. It's always astounding to me. Drive between my town over here, Leavenworth, and Wenatchee. It's only about 25 miles, but about every third day the state got a big truck out there and about 10 workers with big plastic bags, and they fill up these bags and hang them on a post, and the truck comes along and picks up all these bags. The amount of stuff we throw out is just fantastic. And that's just a 22 mile stretch of road. Now, the word ecology is based in a Greek word. It comes from a Greek word that looks like this. Oikos. And that word, oikos, literally means house. But it came to mean a whole lot more than that to the Greeks, because while it did mean house, and you could say, like, which oikos is yours? That's not the way the Greek language behaved, but you understand what I mean? Which house is yours, or where do you live? Well, I live in that oikos. You can't use it that way, and they did use it that way. But that was not the deeper, more profound meaning, because it developed into a much broader and much more profound concept than that. Because for those old Greeks, the house became the center for and a symbol for the totality of life. They were born there, they died there, they were buried right outside the door, they raised their food right there, they laughed there, they cried there, they reared their children there. Everything was centered right there. So it was a little bit like saying, where is your oikos, meaning where is your life? Oh, my life is sort of geographically located here, centered and symbolized by this house. So the word became a word for, not only for house, but for totality. A word that means everything. The total, but in dynamic interrelationship, constant, perpetual, dynamic interrelationship. Because that's where everything was happening. That's where the action was. From that, to they start to use the word also for something that we might call wholeness. Not hard to see how you come, totality or the whole thing. And the concern that some of us have had in more recent years for health as described by wholeness, or illness as defined by brokenness, fits into this kind of a concept. And that's why a hospital I was with for 25 years in Chicago has as its fundamental and basic concept, an ecological approach to healthcare. That is a total person approach, in which not only the physical, the cells of his body or the organs of the body are important, but where the family life of the patient is seen as involved in the illness, in a causative way and also in therapy. You're going to heal, you have to heal more than the kidney, you have to heal the whole person. If you're going to heal the whole person, you have to heal his family also. And you can't really define health in any ultimate terms without describing it in terms of a return to wholeness. Or perhaps, if we can't achieve wholeness in all ways, to a fullness. Fullness, which is even more important than wholeness. I think I could, reluctantly, but I could get along, say, without a leg. I wouldn't be quite, if I had to be amputated, I don't think I'd be quite quite whole, huh? But I would, particularly if I was a football player or a basketball player or something like that, I would really feel that I was far from whole, yet fullness. And we've seen this in so many people. A loss of wholeness. We have seen them find fullness And that's what it ought to all be about, isn't it? Life that is shaken down and abundant and running over and exploding and celebrating. Now, if we think of ecology, not in terms of garbage or pollution of the rivers only, it relates surely to that and importantly. But if we think of ecology in this other sense, then of the oikos, if we think of ecology as being that constant, dynamic interrelationship of all aspects of being, and don't use the word ecology as sort of a synonym for environment, if we define environment as being something that's sort of out there someplace, some geographical or social context in which we live. It is much more than that. It's part of this dynamic interaction. Now again, I suggest, and we'll be moving into this, that it is the Christian church today that has this answer in important, in essential ways. If we're going to move away from ecology by way of fear motivation into ecology by way of reverence, then we're going to have to understand why, what there is to be revered. And that is exceedingly important. Now, I love my church, and I love my church very much. It was in my church that I was born. It is my church that has nurtured me all these years. There are quite a few of them stacked up now. But I have something against my church. It shortchanged me. And it shortchanged me in ways that I deeply resent. It concentrated so much on the second article of the Apostles' Creed that it didn't teach me anything, or much of anything, about the first article of creation. You remember the three, you know, you can use some words or you'd learn in catechetical class, I'm sure, that the first article has to do with creation, the second article has to do with redemption, and the third article has to do with sanctification. Huh? Well, we somehow or another have skipped over and passed that the implications of the first article of creation so rapidly that we don't really understand much about it. This has made it possible for us to think of, say, going to the moon and landing on the moon as an accomplishment of science, period. Now, the astronauts themselves, you remember the first time they circled the moon one Christmas Eve? You're all too young for that. Though, aren't you? You remember it? Huh? It was a great time. It was a great time for Christians. Because those astronauts had something to say that night. Caught up in the awe and the wonder of what they were seeing. In this furthest reach of scientific endeavor that man had ever been engaged in. As they were circling around, they had a message for Earth. And they came on the radio. And what was it? It was those words from the first chapter of Genesis. Do you remember? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I hadn't cried for years and years and years until that night. But what profound celebration. And this claiming of the moon for his lordship. It was a great time. A great time indeed. Yes?
I remember several of us waiting to hear that come on again and again, but we really had to wait. That wasn't on TV too often.
No, it wasn't.
No?
But it's something we ought to get a tape of and play repeatedly.
Yeah.
In our churches, the artwork is nearly always related to the second article, isn't it? Almost all of it. I would like to see something dynamic in our churches, and I've talked to a few architects about this, and I can't get up to sell it to church building committees for some reason. But I think we ought to have Jupiter up there with his moons, circling around, dynamic, alive up there. I think we ought to have microscopes in our Sunday school rooms, so the kids can be introduced to God in the atom or in the crystals. I'm like a little kid when I get my microscope and some crystals, and I look at them through the microscope and some filters that I put on, the cross-field polarization, and see them explode into colors. My wife sometimes gets a little bit annoyed because I might come running up at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, "Wow, look at this one," you know. And she can't, at that time in the morning, quite tune in on it, understandably. Understandably. Now, let's just think back of this creation a bit. You know, here was God brooding over the face of the waters. Now, yeah, I didn't quite tune in on that, I guess, until last September up in Chalet 9, up at the top there. And I was out with my telescope. We had good clear weather that last year this time. This time it looks like we're bombing out on the use of the telescope. But I was out until almost 3 o'clock every morning. And then I'd wander out there and everybody else was sound asleep. All decent people should have been. But I would go up there and now, having been out and freezing and also quite excited about what we had been seeing up there in the heavens, I would sit out on that front deck. And the moon would set back of copper over here. And then things would grow dark and darker and darker and darker until you could hardly make out the mountains. And Buckskin just about faded away, and so did copper. But if sat there long enough and got the eyes adjusted to the absence of the light from the moon, then pretty soon, back in here, some mysterious great masses appeared with a little hint that it was buckskin and copper. And I began to think this is kind of like it was when God was brooding over the face of the waters, formless. But the deep mystery of even that undeveloped, unprogrammed mass that was there at the time. The deep, profound mystery of it all. Well, anyway, you know, he brought light, and that must have been something, huh? And fish that were going to swim in the ocean and in the seas, and animals, a deer and the bears, and then, you know, the moon and the stars. Well, we know a great deal about moon and stars today, a whole lot more, and then less also. Because just think now, with all that we know in astronomy today, with the fantastic development in the field of mathematics that's made it possible for us to know so much more about the moon and the stars, which he has written. Nobody has written the eighth psalm again. That took a shepherd boy lying out on his back on a starry night, you know, seeing this and connecting it to God intuitively, instinctively, immediately. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. Ah, what is man that you're mindful of him? I irritate some people, I think, when I get around the telescope at night, and they say, "How far is it from there to Jupiter?" And I said, "I don't have the slightest idea." Mm-hmm. "How big is Jupiter?" "No, I don't know, it's big. Bigger than Earth." And then they start asking me all kinds of precise questions. And I would like to be a sort of an apostle of ignorance. Because I haven't seen that knowledge, this exploding, developing knowledge, has brought us into any deeper appreciation of the stars or of atoms, or more reverence for the earth itself. We know a lot more about it. But we haven't felt it. We haven't absorbed it. It hasn't become a part of our breathing. And this awareness, this consciousness that Christ dwells in all of creation. Now see, that's part of what I have against my church. Because I was never taught that Christ, this was the Father Creator who brought all of this into being. Very few references were ever made to Christ as Creator. We neatly separated out the Father and his functions from the Son and his functions. And his function was to walk towards a cross and hang there. But there was that time, and remember, when God said to himself, now, after, got the moon hanging up there and the stars where they ought to go and whirling in the way they ought to be whirling and developed these fantastic velocities and these unbelievable magnitudes of space, put everything out there and got everything ready, and then he said, now, let us make man in our image. I hope he'll play back that thing for us someday so we can hear it again. What a fantastic time. And listen to the pronouns. Let us make man in our image. It suggests to us this plural nature of the oneness of God. Now that's like gobbledygook, isn't it? This God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, is an absolute unity. Not just that they've sort of joined together and held hands and said, now let's be one God, but inseparable, indistinguishable. I didn't learn until much later, much, much later. It's one of the excitements of this last quarter century of my life, to come into a realization that Jesus Christ, this one of Nazareth, that he was present in the creation. By him all things were made. That Colossians chapter that I hope that you'll read, where he gets into this role of Christ as the Creator. Now, I think there was a very definite reason for God, now the plural God, deciding that this had to be a total God event or process, this creation, because it had to be made visible. God is a concept that doesn't mean much. The invisible God can never mean quite as much as the God that becomes visible in Jesus Christ. Oh, now, if Jesus is the Creator, now I see something different in this creation than something made by this invisible great power out there, this Father God, that I never got to know, really, unless I got to know him in Jesus Christ. Let us make man in our image, and then, so the whole God, this ecological God, if you please, complete, inseparable, dynamic, constant unity. the Oikos God. That God made this, and I see the Creator, and see the creation then through the person of Jesus Christ. Now there was a, you know, in Genesis it says that God formed us out of the dust of the ground. And I really like that. I'm beginning to like it. I didn't for a long time. I used to stand at gravesides, even my earlier ministry, and shudder a little bit that we had to put this body down into this dirt. I don't anymore. I think back now to that God formed us out of the dust of the ground. Now, I don't know what that means much. I know something about what it means. But if it means that he sort of got down his hands and knees and sculpted out a human form of some kind, that's all right. I don't mind that. I don't believe that. But I that's certainly permissible. That's not the point of the Genesis account, is it? The point of the Genesis account is that this comes out of the hand of God, and it doesn't have to deal with the mechanics of how it came about. And if you want to believe that it took 16 billion years and a great guided, developed, steered out of the hands of God, fine. As long as it's out of the hands of God. That's the point of Genesis. But out of the dust of the ground is important. That part we better not lose sight of. Because he, well, do you remember the name that he gave to the first one that came out of this? Dust of the ground? Adam. Adam? Huh? Sort of the name for mankind is Adam. We've made it just the name of a male back there someplace. You know why he was named Adam? It was because he came out of the Adama. And that's the way the Hebrew behaves. That which comes out of the Adama is named Adam. The Adama is the stuff of this planet. Is the stuff of creation, the stuff of the universe. These are the atoms and the particles, and this is the dust and the dirt. We have been drawn out of it, and that's the meaning of out of the dust you came. Now, if this is the dust that was created by God, and I know God as Jesus Christ, and he has formed me out of this dust, and then comes a time when we are returned to that dust, why should I be so afraid of getting into a hole in the ground? Huh? Now you got to get over feeling of dirt as dirty. And see dirt as something of creation that can be sifted through your hands and held. About 4 or 5 years ago, I had a group here in the fall of the year for, I think a month or so. And we were dealing mostly with creation, or I was, in my part of this thing. So I asked everybody to, as their first assignment, to go out and select 1 cubic yard of Holden, claim it for their own, and to spend time in it every day, a minimum of 2 hours. Well, right away they wanted to know, is that where we're supposed to write or read? No, just sit in it. Just sit in this cubic yard. Now, I have to say that some of us need more than a cubic yard, a little bit more, so you can do this. You don't have to keep it too literally. And some of you got space that you can lend some of us. But to sit in a cubic yard, and then to experience what can be experienced within and out from a cubic yard. For instance, you sit there and you're sitting on something. You're sitting on the ground, perhaps, huh? Either directly or by way of some chair. It's a good idea if you want to do this. Go on up, there's still time. But sometime, find a chance to reach down and sift some dirt through your hands and say, in some mysterious way, here is Jesus Christ. A part of every fragment, of every atom of creation. He is the firstborn of creation, we read in Colossians. And he is the creator and the firstborn of the creation. That is the leader, the central principle of all creation, the central being of it all. Ah, what fun it would be to just be conscious of Christ in the created order by becoming intimate enough with the created order to see through, to see the Christ in it. You can't do that unless you really get intimate with it. We sometimes have some fine thoughts, and sometimes they're very profound thoughts about the beauty of the stars or the moon or the flowers and the trees and the birds. They're redefined when we think of them as having come out of the hand of this creating Christ. This creating Christ inseparably united with the Father and the Spirit into this one God. There came that time when he, after forming us out of the dust of the ground by whatever process, he breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and so man became a living soul. Which suggests we don't have souls, any of us. We are souls. That's what we are. We don't have them. It isn't some fraction of what the human being is in some way that René Descartes would approve of. It is. We are souls. That's what we are. And a soul is something, I suppose, maybe something like person, huh? Would be a better word, or a little closer to it. We became persons, as God is person. This is maybe the image of God, that we are persons, as God is person. And it sets the basis for the relationship. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls talks about God creating us for his eternal company. And that asks us to remember that God wants us very, very much. One of the reasons I resent the neglect of the first article by my church is that it keeps me from understanding that the very first announcement of the gospel was not by angels to the shepherds out over the fields. Bethlehem. The first statement of the gospel was when God said, I want you, and created us in his image to be his eternal company. That is the intent of God. That's the purpose of our existence. To bring us into union with his whole creation and with himself. And when we mess that one up, because we are souls. See, God is not omnipotent. He is not absolutely powerful. Simply because he gave up a good deal of his power when he made us. He said, all right, I'm going to make you persons. You can't be a person and a puppet at the same time, can you? Although a lot of human beings try to shrink their relationship with God down into some puppet relationship where he pulls the strings and guides and nothing happens without God's intent. Well, of course, that's patently absurd, isn't it? Just think of all the evil things that you'd have to hang around God's neck if the other night I talked about Susan. I couldn't possibly continue to blame God for that lousy damn cancer that took her life. If I did, I wouldn't want God, if that's the kind. How could I see here this tender, loving Savior who reached into my sorrow, into my agony, and hugged me? Or who spoke out of the mosaic up there at the church to this fellow in Peter DeVries' book after he'd thrown the pie in the face of the crucified one and said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me. Of such is the kingdom of heaven." But he turned this place over to us and said, "Manage it. We are God's regents on this place. So if there's garbage, it's our responsibility. We're supposed to keep this place for him. We're his representatives. We are the princesses and the princes of his family, of his kingdom, and his regents. And when it gets goofed up, we have goofed." That Colossians passage refers to Christ as the image of God. And it talks of him as being the firstborn of creation. And then says that in him all things were created. But this is the emphasis that I think I've missed down through the years, of seeing Christ so intimately related to the creation itself and to the created order. Now, if I throw some lousy, dirty chemicals into the water that is in some mystical way Jesus Christ, that's different than just polluting some water that may kill me if I drink it. To walk with a kind of a reverence, to see God in this broader, larger, majestic revelation when we see Jesus Christ as Creator. Then perhaps we see the second article and its great, magnificent, wondrous truths in a different light. I like Zorba the Greek. Do you like Zorba? Kazantzakis, magnificent novel. Zorba has taught me so much theology. For instance, his sense of wonder and awe always gets me. He was walking one day along with his partner and boss, and there's a peasant walking with a donkey or with a mule, and Zorba stops and stares intently. And the peasant becomes afraid and says, "Hey, what are you doing? You're putting the evil eye on me and on my donkey." And he hurried off. And Zorba's friend says, "What in the world did you do that for? Why did you do it?" And Zorba says, "Didn't it strike you, boss?" "What do you mean? Didn't it strike me? What do you mean? Didn't it strike you that there is such a thing as a mule?" Sense of wonder, of awe. Zorba tells us something of the profound dimensions of everything that exists, because it is related to the infinite and to the eternal by way of Jesus Christ. By Zorba, the one I was really leading to is, Zorba sees God sitting on a cloud, a big, nice, comfortable, fluffy cloud, using it almost like an easy chair up there. And he's disturbed a little bit, because here comes another one of these sniveling, crying, squabbling people, a repentant sinner. And he's had a lot of them parade past him, says Zorba. And he hears her crying and telling about all of her sins and how terrible she has been and how she doesn't deserve heaven, but she hopes that somehow or another she might be able to squeak in anyway. And God says, ugh, I've had it. So he says, come here. And he reaches out and he takes one sopping wet little cloud over here and he sponges her all off and says, now you're clean, come on in. And Zorba said, now that's a God, you see, because the nature of God is to forgive and to accept. In him were all things made, and in him all things hold together. Now, if he just made them, you can understand them falling apart, huh? But there's some kind of a guarantee, some sort of a hope, that it isn't all going to fall apart, because God is not going to fall apart. If we can say, in another connection, I am persuaded that nothing, there, here, before, after, life, death, principalities, powers, all the rest of it, nothing shall be able to separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus my Lord. Then perhaps there's an echo of that. Confidence that we can come, that the stars are going to stay there, that the moon is going to stay in its orbit, that the planet is going to keep spinning. Or even if this planet is absolutely erased, either by our doing or by something other happening, that things continue and that things are going to be good and things are eternal because God is eternal. Now, it is, according to Paul in Colossians, it is in Jesus Christ that all of this is held together. Perhaps we might think of this as a parallel to the incarnation, when God, who had made us to be his own, to live with him in his kingdom, to be his, when he had done that and we goofed it up, he pursued us. He wasn't going to let us go. The second article is not so incredible if you know the first article. If you know this God, this Jesus Christ God, who created all of this and then said, I'm going to make man, we're going to make man for it in our image so that we can be with him ever. You can't imagine God saying, oh, nuts, he spoiled it, and go off to some other planet to do a better job on it. He wouldn't let us go. He held it together. And he held it together. Held us together with him. By very strange and God-like surprise. I think you can just expect to be surprised by God. How could you define God without surprises? Be terrible if we can reduce him down to some theological statements and formulae. God is surprising us. And he sure surprised the shepherds that night out there, and Mary and Joseph and an innkeeper and a few others, and some wise men from the east surprised them by being a little baby. All the strange ways for God to join us. And then to join us by dying, by being nailed to a cross. Ah, what a God. Now, this is what I mean by saying that if the first article makes the second article credible. The God who created us because he wants us isn't going to be defeated by our sin and let us be separated. So he finds a way to return us and to redeem us, and in some, again, mystical way, to redeem the whole creation. It is this Jesus Christ who holds all things together. Here is the dynamic. Here is the thing that functions within this ecology, to bind together the various forces, influences, facets, appearances, images, bind it all together and make all of it sensible. And he stands at the center of the whole. The atom is his. It isn't only the moon and the stars which is ordained, but the atom and the molecules are his. He is the power of the atom that man takes so much credit for unleashing, sometimes in beneficial ways and tragically in such destructive ways. I wonder if we're going to crucify him once more on a mushroom cloud. His own power, in which he still resides, used as a new cross, even in the form of a mushroom cloud, like we did at Nagasaki and we did at Hiroshima. It would be good to see the redemption of Adam, wouldn't it? It has such fantastic possibilities for mankind. In the alleviation of hunger, in the alleviation of suffering of so many different kinds. But we who are part of a nation that was the first one ever to take this fantastic, magnificent, beautiful energy source for such an evil purpose, I suppose it's understandable that we develop a neurotic fear of nuclear power. Out of our guilt, out of our misuse of the atom, we now stand afraid that the atom is going to retaliate and chew off our ears or our nose or our hearts or kill us. And it can in misuse. Obviously, it's a dreadful thing. It's a dreadful thing to take any of God's good gifts and misuse them, because then they can be used as evil. Oh, it'd be good if we could walk more softly upon this earth, more tenderly, because we know who it is, this earth, inseparably and irreducibly related to the incarnate Christ, the creational Christ. Perhaps we ought to talk not only about the incarnation, but the increational aspect of Jesus. If you do pick out a cubic yard here or some other place, there are some things, great excitements waiting for you. For instance, you can get acquainted with the dust out of which you came and to which you will one day return. I talked about that. You probably can see life in in very simple terms, like, for instance, the ant that's crawling out of the ground alongside of you, and speculate upon that ant, like Albert Schweitzer did. Right? Now, Albert Schweitzer was no mentally retarded human being. One of these magnificent people who stand out every once in a while to lead mankind into deeper, more profound, and more beauteous ways. But he was fascinated with ants. I thought it was kind of childish of the old man to do that, but more and more I began to see that here he was saying something and feeling something that I covet very much. He used to come out of his dining room after the evening meal with the people at the hospital at Lambrani, and after the Bible study kind of thing and devotion, the evening devotions that they had around the table, and then he'd go into his office, but he always carried a cookie and crumbled it up on his desk, and then the ants came. He felt this unity of the creation with Jesus Christ. It wasn't that he thought the ant was such a magnificent little thing, but defined and seen through Christ the Creator, he had this reverence that was so much a mark of this very, very great man. Well, of course, another thing, you can see you sitting there. Huh? I mean, you can feel you can experience you. When was the last time you were ever with you? I mean, solely giving your undivided attention to you, not in selfish ways of what can I grab or something, but just to be. Takes a lot of courage to be, just to be. I gave a class of mine at Lutheran Seminary once, a graduate level class, an assignment. Said, before you read any of the books, before you write any of the papers that you're going to have to do for this course, the first thing you have to do is turn in a little slip of paper saying, I did it. Meaning, I sat for 2 hours doing nothing. And they said, will you please describe or tell us what you mean by doing nothing? So I said, well, just do nothing. Well, can we read? No. I said, do nothing. Well, can we listen to music? No. I want you to just sit there. Why? Well, just sit there. I don't care why. Just sit there. these little slips came to me over the 6 weeks of the course, but none of them got them in the first week. Nobody had been able to sit for 2 hours and sign a statement, put his name to it, that he had sat there for 2 hours doing nothing. One guy came in and said, I did nothing and it was the most profitable thing I've done. I worked out a whole schedule for the whole year now of how I'm doing. So I handed him a slip back and said, go back and try again, you just failed. One fellow didn't get his grade in the course until he'd been gone 6 months, and he wrote and said, oh, what a day. I finally said goodbye to my wife and my kids, kissed them, gave them a big hug, and said, I don't know when I'll see you, but I got to get this done. He drove over to the Yellowstone River, because he was from Montana, parked his station wagon there, put the air mattress out in the back of the car, and stayed there until he had spent 2 hours just being. We're doers, you know. We've got to be doing something. But it is when you sit there just being that somehow or another you meld into the creation itself. It is quite an experience. I mentioned the ants, then there are the flies. But wondrous things. If you think that the fly, you know, that's a very complex business. The eye of the fly has occupied the lifetime studies of great scientists, because it's such a magnificent, complex thing, just the eye of a fly. I have friends who spent, two friends, who spent their whole careers as scientists studying the amoeba. Tiny little squirming thing, you know, and they've seen only through the microscopes. Insignificant, we would think. Their whole scientific life, their whole careers, spent studying the amoeba. I remember the day one of them came and said, "Wow, did we discover something? We've always said that this was an absolutely asexual multiplication process. What we have now discovered is that before the amoeba divides, it comes in contact with another amoeba." I don't know if that means anything, but it was, to them, a great wonder. You know? Great wonder. Wonders thing. If you sit there, you'll hear the bees. And maybe be reminded that without bees, we've been one terrible mess on this planet. Because the bees do this pollination, huh? Without the bees, there'd be no humus. There'd be no soil out of which anything could grow. In the creation, he put such a big responsibility on the bees. And it would be good to look at a bee, and instead of just swatting at him and say, "Get away, you evil thing," say, "Thank you for making life possible on this planet," as do the ants. Farmers plow a lot of ground, but nowhere near as much as ants do. Nowhere near. From that same place, you can look out and see beauty. You can see the trees and the mountains and see the snow starting to fall on top of them. Get out there at night, don't neglect the night, and see the stars and see the moon. Enjoy the solitude. Just enjoy the solitude. If it drives you nuts, try again until you can get it. Because you don't really exist in that fuller sense that you are intended to exist until you can afford to be alone with yourself. How do you expect anybody to live with you if you can't live with yourself? If you make you nervous just being alone with yourself, how do you expect anybody else to put up with you? So we run off to gurus, don't we, on our generation, like they invented solitude or all these transcendental things, instead of just being alone with our God and doing it perhaps most directly by way of the creation itself. Sit there in your square yard and listen. To what? Just listen. In stillness, and perhaps you'll hear the cries of wounded and hurt people.